Welcome to Tea with Nettie from my home as we're still in lockdown. My latest guest for you is our Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment's Chief Executive, Crispin Woodhead, who has been an inspirational presence, particularly in these rather troubled times. In fact, as I record this, he has just called a screen meeting with all the members, and it was really lovely to see everybody again. And he held forth with his visions and ways to overcome the straits in which we're in and told us what's going on. And it was really, really interesting and a very positive meeting. Anyway, he was most entertaining to talk to and quite unstoppable in his flow, as you will see. I apologise for any interrupting. Sometimes it was the only way. Crispin's own varied life, which you will hear about in the course of this, has prepared him extremely well for all the challenges of running the orchestra. I hope you enjoy it.
Tea with Nettie.
Crispin, we are so incredibly lucky to have you at the helm of OAE at the moment, because honestly, I think lesser people would have sort of absolutely run away by now, and you are determined to fight, and you have proved how incredibly resilient you are. And I was just looking at your glorious Technicolor life up till now and looking at all the ways in which you have been equipped to deal with any contingency.
But I think the other reading of it, by the way, it's very kind. I'm not sure I quite recognise the person you're describing, but I think my CV is a narrative of majestically shirking disaster.
Well, but you haven't run away from this one yet, have you? touch wood. Anyway, I mean, I look at the things you've done, you know, I'm just going to give a brief resume because... I love the way you headed it, Crispin's Sorry Tale, when I asked you if you could send me a resume of what you've done. But the things you have done have included being an organ scholar at Oxford, reading French and German literature, the 17th and 18th centuries, the Enlightenment. You have been a crematorium organist and an undertaker, which you never know, might stand you in good stead even yet. You started a artist agency, you've done a lot of teaching, you ran Arcangelo, you in fact sort of were instrumental in starting that up, weren't you, with Johnny Cohen? You were at school with Johnny.
Yes, that's right, with lovely Johnny, yeah. One of the first people to be consciously insulting of me. Johnny is weird because he's now, I think he's probably slightly taller than me, probably osteoporosis is starting to set in already prematurely, but at the time I was quite taller than he was, and he was just this sort of, well, slightly obnoxious, talented, and also redeemingly amusing first former. And I was in the sixth form, and I was deeply earnest and desperately trying to get everything right. And I sort of graduated into the role of accompanying everybody and playing for the choir and playing the organ and things. And he was a little treble in the choir. And as has always been the case, I think he was probably born knowing this, was conscious of where every note was and should be.
Oh, yes. I know that. I encountered him a bit later than you. In fact, he was a student at the Royal Northern when I was coaching a group, you know, and he was sort of this sort of spotty, unbelievably talented, slightly unsavoury looking being, you know, but as soon as he started playing, you thought, oh, wow, this is quite something.
His first organ lesson... He sat there with the chap who taught me. We weren't really, me and my teacher, he's a wonderful man, but I don't think we were psychologically on the same page. But anyway, Johnny had his first lesson with him, or had an introduction to the organ with him. It was on this beautiful Peter Collins instrument at Manchester Grammar. And the teacher said, now then, Jonathan, you can also play those pedals with your feet, just like hands, you know, with a scale or whatever. And so Jonathan just sat there and played an A-flat major scale. Like this.
You mean like that?
And the wonderful thing about long-standing friendships, and he's one of the longest and oldest, is that it hasn't changed a bit. He's still as annoying.
It's so wonderful. You're still such good friends. And you had 5 years running Arcangelo, didn't you? And it must have
Yeah, it
been
was.
quite a wrench for you to leave that,
It
wasn't it?
was. It was lovely, and it was an extreme. I mean, if I'm ignorant today, I mean, it was positively clueless and ignorant when we started that. And in some ways, ignorance is a bliss because when you start doing something like that, you're aware of opportunities and there are things you want to do, and you're not really aware of any of the obstacles or impediments. So you just say, "Well, let's do it then," and you run off and you make a recording with Hyperion, or you start negotiating with EMI, and making things happen, or go to Carnegie Hall, and the number of red lines that you're not supposed to cross, we just wandered back and forth, like a bit like the sort of the demilitarized zone in Korea. It just didn't seem to occur to us. So, I mean, one good example was in Carnegie Hall when we did Apollo Daphne, and I made props for semi-stage production, and so I made this enormous golden bow that was going to cause havoc when we went through Homeland Security because it really looked like a lethal instrument, and so I had to make it so it was like one of these espionage films, starring James Fox or Edward Fox, where it had to be put into a box so that it looked completely innocuous, and then we constructed it lethally when we got to the Carnegie Hall. So that went on stage, and then we didn't have any laurel for the transformation at the end, so she could turn into a shrub. And I've sent someone off, and he went to one of these wonderful New York houses and just went whop and lopped this great big branch of laurel out of someone's garden, came back to Carnegie Hall and said, "Got it!" And this thing was probably riddled with aphids and God knows what. We turned up, and anyone who knows anything about stage management in America knows you just mustn't ever interfere with it because they all have Lee Van Cleef moustaches. They're all thick set, and they'll all hit you with something. If not a fist, then a lawsuit, and they're all paid enormously high salaries. I mean, the people at Carnegie Hall are on zillions for putting up music stands, and you must not interfere because just to move one music stand is probably worth about $4,000 worth of remuneration. So I didn't know this, and I didn't care. So we just showed up with all this gear, with the lethal weapon and the laurel, and then started moving all the stands around. And this whole army, phalanx, brilliant, like a comedy show of Lee Van Cleef came, "Hey, what are you doing there?" And so that was sort of summarizes my life with Arcangelo. We just sort of crashed through all sorts of things, and it was brilliant fun, and it was lovely. And so many of the people that I know in the OAE, I got to know there, lots of friends, and it was very collegial in a way that, I mean, the OAE is, but there's a slightly different dynamic. In Arcangelo, it was kind of, we were all just sort of sitting around, it was sort of slightly hippie. I remember the first gig was, there was Christian Poseidonhoit and Tommy Dunford and Johnny and Jonathan Manson. I think Jude Evans was playing. I think Siobhan Armstrong came along and played harp. And so everyone's just sitting around doing all this wonderful consort work, and it was completely delicious. There's just something about it was just divine, and it's like play rather than work. I don't remember being paid. I'm sure I wasn't. There was a little bit of money, but I mean, when you start something off like that, you have to do it because you want to. I think that's another reason that made us kind of fearless and irresponsible. So it was wonderful.
I think it's fantastic that you've brought all that enthusiasm and sort of why notishness to OAE. But at that time, were you answerable to a board? I mean, it doesn't sound as if it was such a formal setup, or maybe I'm
I have
wrong.
to say that the people who were around on the board and the people who looked after what we were doing and were gradually coaxing us into sanity and order were just great people. We're lovely. And that is absolutely true today. I mean, it is one of the things that is marvelous. I mean, there's much talk, for example, about philanthropy in America and about how, the noughts that are added to gifts are quite extraordinary, but there is a price to pay for that. Anyone who's seen, Mozart in the Jungle, for example, there's an awful lot more truth in there than fiction. And the relationship that you have with donors is often quite strained. People will give you astronomic sums, but then it must be Bohème on Ice. And you think, oh, I rather thought we were going to do a Janáček season. Janáček! And so that's that. And
Yeah.
the thing about the philanthropy and the trustee and the board support that you have in this country is that it's really stellar. It's highly enlightened, it's very generous, and it's generous in the right way in that it's enabling without controlling. And so I didn't know that until I worked in Arcangelo and got to know these people, many of whom are still very good friends and respect and like enormously. And that was another thing that was kind of blessed.
I mean, it must have been something very attractive about OE that persuaded you to desert Arcangelo, unless it seemed a good time for you to leave Arcangelo anyway.
At the time that I applied for the work with Arcangelo, I am proud to say that I was temporary part-time teacher of French at Wickham Abbey School. So I was sort of, you know, a pig in proverbial doing that at the time. But Jonathan Manson sent me a little note and said, I just wanted you to know that perhaps there's maybe a little thing coming up at the OAE. And I thought actually I was a completely preposterous candidate because my career is crazy paving. You've put a very sort of positive and complimentary veneer on it, but actually it's chaos. And I'd done this thing with this lunatic friend of mine from school, and yeah, it had gone well, but in a very eccentric manner. So I didn't feel it at all a responsible candidate, and I took a deep breath before applying. And I was quite daunted by it, I suppose, but I wrote a letter explaining what I thought was important, and I got a sense of things. I also felt slightly guilty because a lot of the times I was working with Arcangelo, I took the you-know-what out of OAE all the time, even to the extent that when I handed out mugs at coffee, I wrote on each mug, not all mugs are the same. They were. And so I was rude, and we were deliberately sort of, you know, ducking around, being mischievous, and trying to upturn things. So I felt a little guilty about it as well, but mostly just unqualified and preposterous. So it is a miracle that I made it through the appointments process, which felt quite rigorous, I have to say. And I haven't been discovered yet, but there's still time.
But it's so funny because the way you described yourself as being very earnest at school and Johnny being one of the first people to actually sort of make fun of you and everything, and the way you see yourself now, that must have been dormant inside you, this sense of fun and adventurism and sort of bloody-mindedness and everything, and it sort of emerged, didn't it?
I only ever got one detention at school. And it was going to a maths lesson. Yeah, one. And it was going to a maths lesson. I didn't say a rude word. Most people who know me well realise that I'm a potty mouth. But I've acquired a sort of southern twang. I remember at my college at Oxford, I said to my tutor, you know what, Dr. Farron, I've been here for 2 years now, and I think I've completely fit in. You know, I've just completely lost anything that I used to talk like, you know. I mean, I wasn't quite that bad. I wasn't from Shameless, but it was definitely there. And he said, oh, Crispin, I think you have some way to go. So that was a wake-up call. But anyway, where was I? I got one detention only at school, and it was I'd just done the piano competition, and very earnestly I'd played Liszt Liebestraum when I can't remember how old I was. I was little, and I'd just done this. And some boy in the sixth form had blustered their way through the Chopin G minor ballad. And I think simply for sort of, you know, Dunkirk heroism that this lad had somehow got from the first page to the last of this Chopin, he got the badge. And I'd sort of very earnestly sort of... So there'd been real heart in it. And I'd sort of played the notes. And so I was walking, and my teacher, maths teacher in the third form, Tweedy Harris, said, I have to say that I thought that the first time anyone had ever used the word miscarriage of justice with me, said, I thought that the result of the piano competition was a miscarriage of justice, certainly, because although the G minor ballad, I suppose one might say, is technically a more demanding piece, particularly the, you know, the regular con fuoco at the end, I actually felt that your rendition as a Liebestraum was, you know, was far more compelling and much more intact, technically, as a performance. And I said, oh, that's very good of you, sir. Thank you so much for saying that. Thank you. And then we got to the door of the classroom, and I said, well, after you. And he had this rule that if anyone came into the classroom after him, you got a detention. So he just shut the door in my face and bonk on my nose as I was saying, that's very kind. That's very kind of you, sir. So this is in miscarriage of justice, what was about to happen. So then the door hit my nose, and he said, oh, sorry, late, detention, like this. So I'd been stitched up. So everything that he said about the piano competition was just a ruse to give me a detention. So how did that feel? So that, in a way, is a verdict on my musical career. I didn't know it at the time, but it's become true later. I was in a pushover in school, so people could easily sort of lean on me, and you know, and I sang treble, and so just to get, you know, the Mickey taken out of me all the time on the bars. People say, "There's Crispin singing," and I loved singing. The only thing that mattered to me at all in the world, certainly until the age of 13, and then it migrated. No, I don't think it changed. I think even until 19, the only thing that really mattered to me was like Worms in D minor, and you know, one day we'll do the wood double service, and oh, do you think we'll ever get beyond, you know, everyone does the Col Reg, but do you think we'll ever do the Te Deum, you know, rather than the Magnum? I was just obsessed with singing treble and singing in church choirs and things, and playing the organ. It was my entire world. I've sort of turned my back on it when I went to music college, because I just thought, I've got to. I remember listening to a recording of Schwarzkopf singing Schubert songs and thought, Mum's been playing things like this to me for years, and I've kind of ignored it. I need to grow up now and learn what singing really is all about. I turn up and think, I know all about singing. I conducted choirs, you know. And actually, I knew sod all. And it was time I had a proper education and learnt about Mozart and how that was done. But I was obsessed with it, and it's the only thing that was important. So at school, I was like Monty singing treble, and it made me very other and bullyable. And so now I'm completely eccentric.
I mean, music has obviously been a constant throughout your life, although you haven't always done it to earn your income, have you?
No, it's been a constant obsession, And I also, I'm one of those people who's probably musical enough to realise what it is to be really musical. And that therefore, it's a constant nuisance as well. You know, I sort of prefer to sort of understand it a little less, maybe, because you can see what people are really doing when they're doing it well, and you understand it, and so I'm sort, you know, I'm not quite as bad as those parents who stand on the side of rugby pitches saying, "Come on, rugby! Come on, drive! But I'm sort of, you know, the kind of musician equivalent of that, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I know that we're always really chuffed if we recognise actors in the audience, because we're great fans of them, and we go and see them and they're coming to hear us. You know, there's this sort of mystique. And I remember the first time OAE actually worked with actors, we did A Midsummer Night's Dream, and Tim Carroll, who was then Master of the Play at the Globe Theatre, came and brought some of his actors from the Globe. And we were so in awe of them, but we could not believe how in awe they were of us. It was just the most extraordinary exchange.
Well, it's just the natural constant in human affairs that you acclimatize yourself to a new terrain, a new level of challenge, and you take for granted all those other echelons through which you've ascended. So it is natural, and actually the greater inspiration perhaps is knowing that inside it there are real people with real issues and concerns, resolving problems. Perhaps maybe at the heart of them there are some quite mundane issues in those problems, like how is this together, and what is actually meant by this? These are some basic questions you might ask about any job. What are we trying to do? You could ask that about making a vanilla sponge. Instantly, I'm hopeless at baking. But then that the knowledge of that terrestrial concern, when you connect it to the outcome, that's magical. You think, wow, those people are just doing straightforward, simple things, and then whoosh, out comes this almost alchemistic project that is almost unrelatable. I remember a teacher I had at school said, "I've only ever encountered two genii in my career," and I remember pausing. Is that the plural? Did we say that? I don't know. So that sort of distracted me. He said, "I once sat next to Benjamin Britten, and once next to Samuel Beckett, both in this economy class of a British Airways domestic flight." And I was thinking, gosh, that's extraordinary. "Really? Did you?" And I was like, "Wait, what was it like sitting next to Benjamin Britten then?" And all my mates were like, "Ew, what?" And I said, the incredible thing was I knew straight away that I was sitting next to people who were they were doing the same things as me. You know, they were having a little cup of tea and they put on their seatbelt. But then there was something attached to that which was remote that they could demonstrate, but I couldn't follow. You know what I mean? I couldn't get there myself, but they could demonstrate. And I knew as soon as I got into conversation, they were saying things which demonstrated some pinnacle of perspective that they could share with me, but I couldn't reach without them. And I thought, oh, that's a good way of putting it. And that was his attitude. And I think, you know, without being fawning and sycophantic, that's how I feel when I see the process of the OAE. Even when you all come off stage and say, oh, it's awful. You know, that I have that horrible thing when I go around backstage saying, well done, everyone. And I know you think, oh, that went clunk and this went clunk. But you're unaware that you've managed to get above the cloud line and that you've availed yourself and everyone else who was with you of that phenomenal perspective. You've done that. And so that's why I come around like a Labrador beaming.
Oh, well, I love Labradors anyway. But Crispin, at the moment, you know, here we are in lockdown and somehow OAE is like a box of fireworks at the moment. It seems to have, and I know that you are so good at sort of thinking about each member and identifying what they might be really quite good at and encouraging them to go out there and do it. So we've had, you know, our OAE musicians on call.
That's Cherry, of course.
We've carried on somehow with our Bark the Universe and everything. We've managed to keep a lot of things going and including sort of audience evenings and things like that, just to try and keep our presence out there. But you're very good at being encouraging to people. And
there are all sorts of things that you know, are on people's minds. And you can't know the answer to those questions necessarily, but you can infer absolutely certain things which we are going to have to do and we do need to do now. And also, you can be very clear about the things that we are capable of doing extremely well, because that's proven. And it's very kind of you to say, you know, that we're trying to be connected to everybody. I think we've got a lot more to do on that, by the way. You know, many more people in the whole family that need to speak to and to get involved in this. But there are certain things that will always be true for us. The day is not going to come as a result of COVID or any other ailment where people don't want to hear great music played well. There isn't going to come a day where people don't want to be told a good story. And there isn't going to be a day ever in the affairs of human beings where they don't want contact with each other. And the wonderful thing about the OAE is that what we do brings those three things together every single time. We absolutely do. If we have a continued disruption to our physical performances in the fourth quarter this year, so from September to December, it's not impossible. Does that mean that that's a cessation of art, an inclusive art at a very high standard, which, you know, satisfies those three things that I said? You know, it's not just great art and done in our way, but it's also story and the human connection. And I think we can really graduate from the fun multi-screen stuff that we've been doing. Yeah, fine, okay, grow up now, and let's start thinking as Handel might, or as Bach might, around the kind of constraints that in which we must operate, because they're the benchmark for creativity and imagination. I mean, the level of imagination that these great people put into their art, it's our job to try and live up to that in the way in which we reproduce it.
Yes, definitely. One of the ways in which you actually really got ahead with a possible eventual outcome of COVID-19 is you proved that we could do a couple of tours, one to Poland and one to Hungary, completely by train, didn't you?
Yeah.
What brought all that on, and what made you really imagine that we could possibly do that and afford to do it and everything?
Well, there's the fluffy bit. I'll do the fluffy bit first, and then there's just the empirical bit, which I'll do second. The fluffy bit is that if you think about any performance, it's a journey anyway. One of the great privileges of doing that journey, and one of the things that was unexpected, was that there is something oddly affirming about travelling through Germany and then Austria and then Poland, and seeing the landscape and understanding it and relating the distance and the time to the people. There is something, well, it is objectively beautiful, unless you simply don't have a beating heart and have no affinity whatsoever with the natural world. I mean, it's objectively beautiful to go through that terrain and that contour and to see it change and to infer from it, from what you see, the different economies, the sort of industrial and the agricultural and the way in which people live. I mean, it's deeply inspiring, I think.
It also felt it put us in touch with people like Mozart and Bach and who also travelled over these terrains.
Absolutely. Of course it did. Of course it did. And, you know, to arrive in Budapest Central Station, my goodness me, what an absolute joy that was. I mean, people pay quite a lot of money to go and see a film where that happens. And we did it. And it's a remarkable experience. And to get to the empirical thing, the difference in metric tonnage of carbon dioxide contribution from our activity to the environment is massive. If people stop asking to go on planes to Poland, then there will be fewer flights. It's obvious. What has happened now in COVID-19, there are fewer flights because people don't want to go on planes, and not as many people are going to go on planes as did before, I suspect. But also the recalibration of personal expectation that life is livable and that there are other opportunities and that economy can grow around new paths, that is something that you have to do in order to activate that kind of social change. I also, by the way, am receptive to the other note of scepticism, and that is that you're not really ever going to deal with major productive response to the environmental crisis if you rest on individual decision making. I understand that absolutely. I think that's probably right. And the best way, if you like the client earth way, is to put the onus of responsibility on government and corporation so that they make decisions that are constructive towards environmental change. That's why I think that train journey to Budapest is so important. And it was good for us. And at the end of it, I just thought, well, if it was that good for us, you know, you've got all these people together at the same time, just imagine what you could do with them. Just imagine what they can get out of that journey for themselves and in their research and appreciation of music, the performances that we can do on the way, the connection that we can form with the world, and how we can think about touring in the future. So it was a fundamentally good thing, I thought.
You've got a very busy home life, haven't you? And you never miss a concert or tour unless there's an
One of the things I found, I have an enormous capacity for things that I can take on and then neglect.
Well, I mean, I've noticed you falling asleep once or twice, when that's quite
understandable. You see, I feel slightly vilified about this because Jonathan Cohen started this because I fell asleep on a coach, which I think is perfectly reasonable. And I did look like a cadaver, so he took a photograph of that. I think I had a beard at the time as well, so a bearded cadaver, which is worse, I think, possibly. So no offence to anyone who is a bearded cadaver. I do apologise, but it's not a look that suits me. Anyhow, he then broadcasts this on social media and it still pops up every now and then. So he started that venerable tradition of shaming me. And then I fell asleep. It wasn't my fault. In Shanghai, whilst Ian Bostridge was singing the last bit of Sile Ti Vanti, and he noticed, he was singing his Alleluias or whatever. And then Suzanne Doyle from Asking Us, bless her, got round with a camera and took a little portrait of me. But you see, the thing is, in my defence, I don't know whether other people find this, but the more closely I listen, the less I'm interested in looking. And so I switch off what I'm looking at, and then I go into a state of mind which is actually very, very close to falling asleep. And I try and stay there because then I can really hear things and I really understand what's going on, and I'm sort of inside the score. But it is risky. You know, great OEE performances that I've been to are sort of entrancing. They are. You do lose a sense of time. They do become so enveloping that other things sort of cease to matter, you know, and it is a kind of sleep state. I mean, it's mesmerizing, and you it's one of the great consolations, because music is this transient thing, but it gives you just a sort of an extra degree of holding on to that moment. Time lasts a little bit longer, it's a bit more permanent, not quite as fleeting.
Yes, I think actually in December, when we were recording with Sir Andras Schiff, the two Brahms piano concertos, and I think the whole orchestra was sort of pulled into that bubble. You know, I think we spent, considering it was recording sessions, we spent an awful lot of time being rather transported, you know, and losing
touch with
reality.
It was utterly remarkable, wasn't it? That it was such a wonderful experience. I loved the whole atmosphere of that project, and going into that great big fish tank where they have the engineers, and Andras was sitting at the desk next to his friend Christoph doing the engineering, and everybody came in with their score and intently, and people were all frowning over certain bars and things like this, and they stopped and took his headphones off and said, "Well, we've all decided what to do. Let's go from letter B." And everyone went, And I just thought, wow, this is fantastic. This is fantastic. There's this complete unspoken agreement on what to do next.
It's true, and when you're doing things without a conductor, it's so enabling because every single person feels they have the responsibility, and it becomes much more like chamber music. And that's why we all wanted to keep going to listen, because we then it told us exactly what to do once we'd ascertained that the engineers had done what they felt they could do.
And that there are paradoxes in recording because there are all sorts of rookie mistakes that you can make, and you can inculcate a kind of red light syndrome where people start making unforced errors because of the psychology you've imposed on the music they're trying to play. And so, you know, there are those who know exactly how to say the right thing. But then you can also get the sort of, yeah, just again from 16, violas just a little bit sharp on the D flat. But then people can feel very particularized in that environment. And then the whole thing starts to go downhill. And what was marvelous about the project with Andras is that he just kept playing through that. And as a result, the outcome was evidently terrific.
And actually, going back to thinking about when there's no conductor, we all take more responsibility. One of the spin-offs of our green trip, our going by train, when everyone had bonded so much, it was quite interesting that more and more of us went out during the rehearsals to listen to the balance and give feedback. You know, we were all really, really taking responsibility for that. And people from, you know, anywhere in the band, you know, in the old days, it might have been a principal player or something who went out, and everyone wanting to feed in and make it as good as it could possibly be, and listening to what the audience were listening, rather sort of getting. Rather than just concentrating on what we were projecting, but also concentrating on what they would be receiving.
The abandonment of that kind of hierarchical view in the way that it's all done is so important, and getting everybody to listen and getting everybody to feel as if they have the conductor's right over a performance, I think is when the OA is at its strongest. You know, having that freedom and voice, I don't think there's anything more valuable.
With OAE in particular, because we have the unhomogenized instruments. I mean, that they're, you know, very, very pungent
Well,
and
that's great as well, isn't it? I mean, when people really admire fantastic buildings or a great piece of furniture or a wonderful painting, they're not necessarily saying, "Don't you think the acrylic is remarkably consistent?" They're not talking about that at all. It's the irregularity. It's the insanity sometimes in those objects, which really gives it the greater dignity. And so, I just think I think it's so. I mean, it's like what Philippa says about when she was skeptical. You know, Philippa Brownsword, our orchestral manager, who's been with us, been with the OAE pretty much since the start, and remembers everything as if it was yesterday. And she said she was deeply skeptical about Beethoven being given a historically informed performance rendition. And then she heard it, and then this lifting of suppressing varnish on the whole lot brought out so many colours and excitements that she sort of almost instantaneously converted, could never go back really to what you can. I mean, obviously, if a great modern orchestra plays Beethoven, it's still a joy, isn't it? But that's not quite what we're talking about. But the real connection with the score, you never really feel as if you've come home until you hear that again.
What I also wanted to find out, just because you are so resourceful, when you're not actually working and thinking and dealing with OAE, do you have any time to do things that you really, really enjoy doing that help you sort of switch off?
I'm a big tinkerer, and I like building things. So in this COVID-19, I built a greenhouse, and that's where I'm now developing my chili and tomato plants and things. Got a lemon tree in it. Actually, in all honesty, even though I'm a thwarted musician, and always will be, one of the things that I've not been able to do for a very long time, actually, not since I left the Royal Northern, actually, is practice properly. Because as soon as you go on the path of, you know, being a grown up and doing something else, you don't have the time to practice. And you know what it's like. If you're going to practice seriously, you can't sort of mess around. You can't sort of vamp through something and think that somehow it will come together and that will do. There are things you do and don't. The COVID-19 thing and the absence of commuting has given me time in which I could allocate reliably disciplined commitment to practice. And so I have been able to do that. So I've always wanted to learn the C sharp scherzo, Chopin scherzo. So that's nice. I'd had a hankering to do. There's that gorgeous Rachmaninoff a transcription of the violin E major. It's just absolutely delightful. And to revise the B flat partita and things like that, maybe do a bit of Mozart. But actually to be able to do it properly and, you know, to give time to, you know, in the way that you should, like if there's someone sitting next to you with the ruler saying, hand separately.
But actually, that's amazing that you're doing that and you're motivated to do that, because I think there are probably a lot of performing musicians who are feeling very unmotivated to practice, because usually one goes from one sort of event to the other, you know, and if you've got something to practice for, you really, really put in the hours. But I find I'm sort of doing studies and I'm playing Bach every day, but it there's a feeling of coasting. I haven't got the concentration that you obviously have.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think one of the things that liberated me is that I know I'm never ever going to play them to anyone apart from me. And that's
Well,
fine.
it's been so nice talking to you.
I'm constantly thrilled to be talking about the OAE or thinking about it and all aspects of it, by the way. I mean, the players are, of course, utterly remarkable, each and every one of them. You know, there'll be a second violin sitting there somewhere thinking, he doesn't mean me. I do. I absolutely do. You can count on it. So that's marvelous. But it's also a pleasure just talking about the whole operation of it, because maintaining the arts in society, I mean, Louis XIV regarded prosperous arts as being a confident statement of the nation's munificence and capacity. You know, I mean, not no, we all know this, and no small part of projecting power, but it really is an indication of the health of society that and civilization that an organization like the OEE can persist, and that there are good people who will help pay for it and will nurture it and give it advice, that there are brilliant players who commit not just to playing the stuff, not just learning the notes, but I mean, often the hardest challenge of all, which is learning very from repeating well-known music and then finding new insight and unveiling new ramifications of the truth in them, and the staff, incredible people that I work with, all of them highly able, very very well educated, deeply committed, endlessly troublesome, and so constructive. So it's you know, talking about them is you know, that's all I'd need really. I just need a tree. If this is Desert Islanders, I just need a tree that would listen, and then I'd just spend all day talking about that.